listening to The Leonard LoPage Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC. I'm Julie Burstein. I'm in for Leonard LoPage on this lovely summer afternoon. In the United States, the rate of obesity is soaring, and the cost of obesity-related health complications is climbing. These are projected to reach $344 billion a year by 2018. Mark Bittman has proposed a drastic solution to get Americans to change their unhealthy eating habits, levy a tax on junk foods that would be used to subsidize healthy food. He wrote an opinion piece titled "Bad Food, Tax It and Subsidize Vegetables" in the July 24th Sunday Review section of the New York Times, and he joins me now to talk about his idea. Welcome back to the Leonard LoPage Show.
It's really great to be here with you.
Really wonderful to have you here. So why do you think a tax on these bad foods is called for?
You know, someone just said to me, why not just tax all consumption?
there is such a thing in other places.
Yeah, well, there is here, too. It's called a sales tax. But this is a focus tax. Or this would be.
Yes, would be. You've got a little ways to go before it is.
Yeah, I don't think it's happening tomorrow. But this is a focus tax that makes a value judgment. And the value judgment is there are foods that we know that are bad for us. They're bad for us. They're bad for the environment. They're bad, in many cases, for animals. They're bad for the land. They're bad for the air, the water, etc. We know this. These things are facts. This is not debatable. I mean, it's debatable by people who care to debate. It's like saying the earth is flat. It's not debatable in that sense. So what can we do about this? We've done, depending on how you count, 30 or 40 or 60 years of education about, gee, maybe you should eat less saturated fats. Maybe you should eat less salt. Maybe you should eat less sugar. Maybe you should eat... none of that education can square up against the onslaught of marketing that food companies, big food, whatever you want to call it, bring to bear in trying to sell their stuff. So how are we going to discourage people from eating badly, and how are we going to encourage people to eat well? This is the best answer I can come up with.
Well, you know, when I read it, I thought about the years when my mom smoked and the years when suddenly cigarettes got more and more expensive. And that, thank goodness she stopped smoking, but that was one of the pieces of her decision, was suddenly it was really expensive to smoke cigarettes. So was that something that you thought about? Was there are other things that we've taxed in a way that make them less attractive?
Well, cigarettes is the obvious and closest parallel. But here's an interesting thing about cigarettes. Most states tax cigarettes, but they tax them at really, really different rates. So what's the state with the highest cigarette tax? New York. Mm-hmm. And New York's cigarette tax is about $4 a tax a pack. Basically doubles.
A pack.
Yeah, a pack.
Wow.
Which basically doubles the cost of a pack of cigarettes. Many places it's $4 and here it's $8, something like that. Which state has the lowest rate of tobacco smokers in the country? New York. So like it or not, this is effective. You tax things at a point at which it discourages consumption. And no one is saying cigarettes are illegal, and they're not illegal. They've become socially, in many places, socially unacceptable, but they're not illegal. I think we learned our lesson with prohibition around that stuff. No one is saying you can't eat or you shouldn't be able to eat Pringles or cheeseburgers or Coke or any of that stuff. Let's discourage its consumption by raising the prices. And at the same time, let's raise money by discouraging its consumption. And at the same time, let's use that money to subsidize the stuff that we want people to eat and make it more accessible. Because we'll get into this, I'm sure, but in a lot of places, it's not so much that fruits and vegetables and other unprocessed fresh foods are expensive, although for some people, of course, they are. But it's not always so much that they're expensive, but that you can't find them.
Yeah, that was going to be one of my questions, is that there are areas, even in this city, where it's much easier to find processed foods than it is to find oranges.
Well, in this city, in many cities, in many suburbs, in many, many rural areas, I mean, I don't like the term food deserts, but it's useful because everybody knows what it means. But what we're talking about are places where it's difficult to find fresh food. And you can shop for some kind of food in a convenience store, in a bodega, in a liquor store in many places. But what I proposed in the piece, and I actually got myself quite excited about this because I thought these were good ideas, was subsidizing. You know, I originally said, well, let's subsidize 5 staples or 10 staples and let's make them from regionally produced. And all of those are very nice ideas. But the fact is, let's subsidize fresh food, whatever the number, whatever the type, whatever the source, and let's make it so widely available that no one has that everyone can get it easily. And so I'm thinking vending machines, which if you look at my piece, there are links to vending machines that already dispense fresh food. So it's doable.
In other countries, right?
Iowa, which is another country.
But I know in Japan they do this,
too. In Japan they do it?
Yeah.
There's a company in California that's trying to do this on a for-profit basis, actually, to sell vending machines that vend healthy food, which is a good idea. I don't think they're doing it very well so far, so I won't mention their name, but it's an idea. But also sell or distribute this food in daycare centers, in schools, in libraries. Places, you know, libraries are very underutilized at this point, but they're central. Everybody has a library. In 7-Elevens and other convenience stores, in bodegas, in liquor stores, and of course in supermarkets, but make this stuff be everywhere along with information about how to cook, by which I mean recipes and even community organized cooking schools, maybe subsidization of cooking equipment. I mean, as long as you're fantasizing, why not have a good fantasy? So
it's complicated, though. I know in our town, home ec was still something they taught in the middle school. And just this year, they've decided they're going to take that out and do technology. And there was a hue and cry because people love having their 11-year-olds come home and say, I want to cook dinner for you. But technology becomes the thing that's the focus.
You know, well, that's a tough choice because you're not going to argue that kids shouldn't learn about technology. One might argue about algebra, but you know, that's a tough that's a tough choice also.
Yeah.
You know, the really tough choice is how do you raise enough money for schools?
Right, for
that's,
everything.
That's another issue. Yeah.
But you know, when I think about vending machines for fruits and vegetables, I mean, Pringles last pretty much forever in a vending machine.
Right.
So that is probably one of the biggest challenges, I would guess.
Well, there are issues, but even, you know, I believe these vending machines at the Times, it's really unbelievable how stacked they are with junk. And then with the so-called healthy alternatives, you know, the air quotes here, whole grain chips. And I mean, these things that are really, it's just junk in another form.
And the Nutribars and the things I don't know whether that's a name, but yeah.
Yeah. There are things that with refrigeration or without, you can dispense. I mean, apples to name the most obvious.
Yes.
Grapes, which, you know, have a shelf life of a week in a refrigerator. These things have to be stocked. Okay. Maybe there's more work involved. That's okay.
At about the same time as your piece came out, there was all this hoopla about McDonald's changing the Happy Meals to include fresh vegetables and less French fries.
What you just said is a perfect example of what a tremendous public relations victory this was for McDonald's, since they're not including fresh vegetables.
Oh, they're not.
They're including a few apple slices.
Apple slices.
Apple slices.
Fruit,
not, you know,
not...
But a quarter, probably a quarter of an apple per Happy Meal. This is actually a subject of tomorrow's column. Which I was just finishing in your lovely waiting room.
Very nice. Not playing the piano, but finishing a column.
But yeah, what's happening now is McDonald's and fast food companies and junk food companies in general are saying, look, we can take care of this ourselves. We're going to define what's healthy and what's not healthy, and we're going to give you healthy food by our definition. And that's just not going to cut it. I do think that's a different discussion. We can have it, but that's not going to cut it.
I am speaking with Mark Bittman, who is a columnist for The New York Times and the author of Food Matters and How to Cook Everything. And his piece on July 24th was Bad Food, Tax It, and Subsidize Vegetables. So which foods would you tax? What would you choose to say? What are the biggest culprits here?
Well, the people who study these things, and this has become a big deal in academia, there are, I think it's safe to say, dozens of people looking at at how to make these taxes work and what makes the most sense. And the people who are studying these things are saying soda is the low-hanging fruit. Soda is the obvious first choice. So why is soda the obvious first choice? But it has no nutritional value. And, you know, in fact, it's very close to cigarettes. It's absolutely worthless, and it damages your health. Whether it's addictive or not is debatable, but it certainly can be called habit-forming. So soda is the low-hanging fruit. But I think, you know, as someone said to me, the goal is clearly not to have people go into McDonald's and say, can I have two Big Macs, a large fries, and a glass of water. The goal is to have them eat something that's entirely different. So I think the next step I would like to see a tax on foods that are judged to be detrimental. And we can figure these things out. And we can even scale this. We can say, for example, a donut is somewhat less unhealthy than an order of fries, or vice versa. I don't know. You look at calories, you look at saturated fat, you look at sugar content, you look at chemical ingredients, you look at whatever you want to look at. This can be done. I mean, this is why God invented computers, right? and bean counters, for that matter. This stuff can be done. And you do it proportionally. So, you know, maybe there's a 50-cent tax on an order of fries, and maybe there's a quarter tax on a donut, and maybe there's a quarter tax on a Snickers bar, whatever it is. And none of this makes it prohibitive, although, you know, people will argue, well, it's discriminatory against poor people. We can get to that. But the taxes are real. It's not like the nickel deposit on a soda bottle, which no longer encourages anybody to recycle it. Where there aren't recycling laws, everybody throws away their soda bottles. And even where there are recycling laws, it needs to be a tax that amounts to something, a quarter, 50 cents, something that makes you think twice. And, you know, I was on CBS last week. The early show did a piece that had me on it for a second. But it was interesting. They interviewed two young women on the street here in the city and said to them, if there were a 50-cent tax on those sodas and chips you were drinking, they'd say, no, we wouldn't do it. Whether that's true or not isn't the point. Some people won't. And that's exactly the point.
So you wouldn't go quite to the $4 surcharge on hamburgers or cheeseburgers.
Like I said, it's not up to me. It's the academics are looking at it. Eventually, as I said, bean counters and computers will look at it. What's the goal? Do you want to discourage consumption by 10%? Do you want to discourage consumption by 20%, 30%? It's not going to be more than that. And also, is your primary goal to discourage consumption or is your primary goal to raise money? Because there's a point at which they cross, because if you discourage too much consumption, the amount of money you're raising goes down. My argument would be discourage as much consumption as you can and take the money as a bonus. But the cash money is a bonus. As much as you discourage consumption is how much you're saving in healthcare costs.
Well,
that's a big deal.
Exactly. You propose that this is a win in two different ways. One is you raise money to subsidize things that would make people healthier. And the other is, I mean, that $344 billion cost is quite extraordinary,
right,
to think. And that's just 7 years down the road.
And further down the road, we're looking at, according to the American Heart Association and the American Diabetes Association, we're looking at something more than $1 trillion a year in healthcare costs based on just heart disease and diabetes alone. Those are both preventable. Those are both, you can call them lifestyle diseases. You can call them chronic diseases. You call them whatever you want. Those are diseases of choice in a way. You choose to consume the stuff that ultimately makes you sick. And, of course, we're all for freedom of choice, but are we all for paying for each other's illnesses? And this, you know, this brings up the tobacco thing. This brings up, why are there laws requiring people to wear seatbelts? Why are there laws requiring people to wear helmets while they're riding motorcycles and so on? It's because the costs to society are so great of this self-destructive behavior that we say, look, fine, you can do these things, but you got to take care of yourself. And I think this falls in along those same lines. You know, globally, for the first time in history last year, or in 2009, for the first time in history, more people are dying of lifestyle diseases, chronic diseases, than of communicable ones. And those lifestyle diseases tend to be diet-related. They're not entirely diet-related, but a lot of them are diet-related. So this is something we can do something about this.
I am speaking with New York Times columnist Mark Bittman about why he thinks taxing unhealthy foods like sodas and subsidizing vegetables would help us all become a little healthier. And we'll be back with more after a break. I'm Julie Burstein. I'm in for Leonard Lopate, and I am here with Mark Bittman, who is the author of Food Matters and How to Cook Everything, and also a New York Times columnist who had a column a week ago about whether or not we should tax unhealthy food. And there's a link on the Leonard Lopate show page to that article. Mark, one of the things as you talk about this, and one of the things that became a very lively debate among the people who responded to your article is, you know, you talk about the nanny state. There are people who say, wait a minute, I want to be able to make my own decisions. How dare you do this? What's your response to that?
Well, I wouldn't say that you're not able to make your own decisions. I would say that we're going to cost these things out a little bit differently than we have in the past. The way we cost this stuff out now is first we subsidize the production of food that's bad for you. So we directly subsidize corn, which goes into making corn oil and high fructose corn syrup and cornmeal and other sort of things that are at best neutral from a nutrition perspective and at worst harmful. And we subsidize soybeans also, which are used to produce most vegetable oil, which is used for frying. And, you know, if you look at Omnivore's Dilemma, Michael Pollan has a really interesting analysis of a chicken McNugget, which has something like 58 ingredients and 40 or 60% of them are derived from corn. And then, of course, they're fried in soybean oil. So the stuff that we least want people to eat from a health perspective is directly subsidized.
So there's already a financial equation going on that's beyond our pocketbooks, that comes out of our tax dollars and subsidizes the production of this.
Well put. I mean, it's not beyond. We are paying. We are right. Already social engineering the way that we eat, but we're social engineering it to our detriment. Why not look this squarely in the eye and say, as a society, we'd rather socially engineer our diet to our benefit? And that's, you know, the state, you know, the nanny state thing is just the most specious argument there is. Because what is a society? A society is a group of people who band together, presumably for their common good. Now, you can argue about whether we're acting for our common good right now or not. Many of us would argue that we're not. And in fact, many Tea Partiers would argue that. Many people from different walks of life would argue that we're not acting in our benefit. How do we go about doing that? That's what I would say is the big question. You know, this is not as obvious as, do we need a sewer system? Yeah, we need a sewer system. Is it nanny state to build a sewer system or to build a road? When you need those things, you do them. This is obviously more subtle and more complicated, but I think it's pretty clear. If you look at it, it's pretty clear.
One of our listeners left a comment on the show page saying, studies have shown that consumers make decisions considering the prices on the shelves and not factoring in taxes. Is that something that you ran into, that this charge needs to be understood and known to the consumer to really discourage consumption?
This is a very nice comment, because it's actually one I can take to heart, and it's absolutely true. Studies have shown that consumers buy things based on their shelf price, not on their tax price, and that's why all the academics who are now involved in figuring this tax stuff out are saying this should be an excise tax. Now, an excise tax is levied on the manufacturer or on the retailer or somebody other than the consumer. The consumer, of course, obviously pays for it. But the point is that excise taxes show up in the shelf price. So if your can of soda is a dollar and the tax is a quarter, the shelf price of the soda is now a dollar and a quarter. It's not a dollar and then you pay a quarter at the register. It's a dollar and a quarter. So it's the right point. And that's why people are moving towards excise taxes in this discussion. Still mostly a discussion, but a lively discussion.
Well, that's, you know, the responses were very lively. And I wanted to ask you, you know, you have a chance to raise this to a lot of people. But as you say, you're not the one who's going to be making these decisions. What are the steps that you would want to see taken to see that this kind of thing might happen?
Well, here we go. We've started a conversation. I mean, I wrote, I was talking about taxing soda a couple of years ago in a series of talks that I gave around the country. I wrote a smaller piece about it in the Times about 18 months ago. This is the best, this is by far the strongest reaction that I've gotten. So clearly there's a little more acceptance here. And I think the idea of trying to lower healthcare costs resonates with people. And I know a lot of people really like the idea of subsidizing good foods, because a lot of people are concerned with how are we going to get the foods that are better for us. And here's sort of an answer. What has to happen is, you know, I know of several Congress people and a couple of senators who would support this thing. They're at this point basically afraid to say anything because they're so far out on a limb. What's going to happen is that San Francisco or Davis, California, or Philadelphia, or Burlington, Vermont, or God bless us, New York, is going to pass one of these taxes. It's going to happen somewhere. And it's going to be clear that it's a moneymaker. And in this day and age, if you can pass something that's good for people and makes money, I think it's a winner. And I think it will snowball at that point. Now, whether this starts 6 or 18 months from now or 20 years from now, I have no clue. But it's a good thing to talk about. I think raising the issue is, well, obviously, I think it's a good thing.
Here in New York, there were decisions made not to tax things, but to say things like trans fats just are not going to be allowed, which is a slightly different way of approaching all of this.
Well, I think that if the city administration, and you'd probably do better to talk to them than to me about this, but I think if the city administration had its druthers, it would be taxing soda and taxing a lot more than that. The city cannot levy taxes without state approval, and the city wasn't getting state approval for that. So what, I mean, like it or not, what the city administration has done is engineer the things they're able to engineer, and to the extent they can take things into their own hands, they have, as they've done with
traffic. So these sorts of regulatory like piece is something that they're allowed to do.
Well, and certainly the public education piece, you know, the pouring on the fat campaign, which is as graphic a campaign as anyone has ever seen for arguing that soda is bad for you. And I would wager to say it's had very little impact because, again, decades of education around this stuff has had no impact whatsoever.
Why do you think that is? What is it that keeps us, even though we may know these things are bad for us, keeps us from voluntarily saying, you know what, I'm going to pass up on that thing that may make me sick and go for something else?
I think there's two or three answers to that question. Certainly a percentage of the population has changed the way that they eat. And it tends to be the best read and the best educated percent of the population, general segment of the population, generally speaking. But I said this at the top, and I think this is true. All the education that you have cannot hold a candle to the have it your way. And well, I can't even think of these slogans because I try to resist hearing them. But, you know, if we walk out the door here, you know, in the West Village or Soho or wherever we are, we are not going to encounter people saying, here's how you might try to eat better, or would you like to buy these lovely vegetables I've just cooked? We're going to encounter fast food chains. I mean, there's a Subway right across the street. I noticed a couple others. There's probably a dozen fast food chains within three blocks of here. We could probably buy any number of soft drinks within seconds of where we're sitting now. And we're constantly encouraged to do that. If we turned on a commercial radio station, if we opened a paper and so on, we are not going to see Mayor Bloomberg's pouring on the fat ad campaign. We're going to see have it your way. And that, you know, we're talking about marketing campaigns in the billions of dollars annually for fast food and junk food. We're not you know, the educational arm of the USDA is requesting some tens of millions of dollars. I can't remember if it's $13 or $30 million, which is something like 1/3% of the budget for marketing fast food alone in this country.
And as part of it, too, getting back to cigarettes, that fat and sugar and all of these things that can be bad for us are also delicious, and people develop a taste for these things.
Myself, my weakness is salt.
Mike, son, that's the exact same thing. Yep.
Of course they're delicious, and no one's saying you shouldn't be eating this stuff. But you shouldn't be eating it much, and you shouldn't be eating it in the form that we've produced it. fat is good for you. Salt is not bad for you. Salt is good for most people. It's not bad for most people. Sugar is tolerated, although there are people who argue about that, but not in the quantities that we're eating this stuff, not in the forms that we're eating this stuff. And the other question, which we haven't really touched on, and it's a tricky one, is this stuff addictive? And it's not. It's clearly not as addictive or not addictive in the way that nicotine, which is a real drug, is addictive. But David Kessler, who's a former FDA commissioner, argues that it's addictive in the sense that it's beyond habit forming, and that if you walk past a fast food place or you walk past the kind of food that you've been trained to crave, or you go to a vending machine and those are your options, you are going to want it. It triggers the desire. The food itself, the presence of the food triggers the desire. So how do you counter that? You make it more expensive, you make it less ubiquitous, and you make the alternatives more ubiquitous.
I'm speaking with Mark Bittman, who's a columnist for The New York Times and author of many books, including Food Matters and How to Cook Everything. We're talking about his column that was in The Times about a week ago about the idea of taxing unhealthy food and subsidizing healthy food. You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show here on WNYC and WNYC.org, and there's a link to the article there. Now, Mark, one of the things we talked about at the beginning is, and you mentioned now, the people who can and do eat more healthily are often the ones who are more educated, probably have a little more dispensable cash.
Or a lot.
Yeah. Or a lot more dispensable cash. Would this be a tax on people who are poor? Is there a way of creating this so that it doesn't become yet another burden on people who are poor?
Well, I don't know that it's a, you know, certainly it would make it more difficult for poor people to drink soda if you tax soda. Now, if you're going to argue, and you know, you can buy soda with food stamps right now. If you're going to argue that poor people, like everybody else, should be entitled to buy whatever they want to buy, it's tough to counter that argument. But if you look at the benefits to poor people of this kind of tax, one, because poor people tend to be less healthy than wealthier people, you're going to improve their health by taxing the stuff that we agree few of us should be consuming, or none of us should be consuming in much quantity. And two, you're subsidizing the stuff that everybody, including advocates for poor people and poor people themselves, say they have trouble getting a hold of. So, you know, I think at some point you have to make a value judgment. How do you want this thing to work? There's no ideal situation here. You can't say, okay, we're going to let poor people do whatever we want and we're going to bear the costs of that. You can't let anybody in this country do exactly what they want. We have to be able to control healthcare costs. We have to be able to control the damage to the environment and so on down the line. A lot of this stuff is coming from, for want of a better term, bad food. So as you tinker, it may seem more or less fair to some people. But I think that by discouraging poor people from drinking soda, you're improving their health. And by encouraging them to eat, to be able to buy and afford whole foods,
and making it available to them,
and making it more accessible, that you're encouraging good health. So, yes, it's social engineering, but it seems like a good decision to me.
Another piece that we've talked a little bit about and you mentioned at the beginning is kids and also recipes. And I wondered if you had thoughts about how to encourage kids to eat more healthily and to actually learn how to cook.
You know, really, at the end of the day, the target for all of the stuff we're talking about is kids, because to change a 40-year-old's behavior is so much harder than to change a 40-year-old's
behavior. That's why all the advertising is geared towards kids.
40% of McDonald's ads go towards children. And probably of the remaining 60%, half of that goes towards parents bringing their children. It's kids. I have a tiny little anecdote here, which is that once I was out on Long Island trying to help this family for a TV show. I was trying to help this family learn how to cook better. And it was a mom and a dad who were around 50 and two teenage boys and a three-year-old girl, and went back 6 months later. And it was the young kid who had really, really changed the way that she ate.
The three-year-old.
And that was because she was not everybody, up until 2 years old, we're all pretty much the same in terms of our eating habits. After that, the fast food stuff really kicks in. And if you can start addressing what kids eat and how kids eat when they're really, really young, you can form lifelong habits. Fast food companies know that. That's why they want to advertise on kids' shows. But we know that also. And that's why, yes, you know, I'm totally in favor of home ec in schools. I think that what has to happen is we make these changes. We let the grown-ups do what they can do. And, you know, things take generations. I mean, look at this. Our smoking rates are half what they were in the 60s. And half as many people begin smoking now as used to begin smoking. That's the kind of change that we need to see. But, you know, most people who smoke now are older, are people who became addicted when they were young.
So if we have this conversation in 50 years, we may be seeing a lot of healthier, thinner people if something like this actually happens.
From your mouth to God's ears, as we say.
I've been speaking with Mark Bittman. He is a columnist at the New York Times, and he's talking about why he thinks taxing unhealthy foods like sodas and subsidizing vegetables would help us all become a little healthier. His article, Bad Food, Tax It and Subsidize Vegetables, appeared in the July 24th edition of the New York Times Sunday Review, and there's a link on our Leonard Lopate homepage. Thank you so much for joining us, Mark.
It's fun, Julie. Thank you.